Introduce the speaker, whose face is very familiar to me, because he happens to be a member. But further than that, I'm afraid I can't inform you. I'm always intrigued when I find somebody's name is spelled R-A-L-E-H, because some people call it Ralph, some call it Rolf, and some call it Rafe. I believe Rafe is the oldest form of it. Can you inform me on that?
I know there was an argument at my christening. My mother said one thing and the clergyman another. Ralph Wynne.
Yes. Mr. Ralph Dabner, on Tales of a Family, he will talk for about 20 minutes and then show his pictures. So, a welcome to our speaker.
Tales of a Family. Suppose I begin with possibly the funniest. One morning, a century or more ago, a young merchant sailor on shore leave was walking in his Wiltshire village. And there he met a tiny, rather spoilt young lady of his acquaintance. Asked how she fared, Catherine told him she was to be married on April the 30th. Said Joseph, "You can't do that. I've always wanted to marry you." Catherine smiled and explained that all preparations were now complete. "If you must marry him," said Joseph, after a pause, "I suppose you must. But it doesn't leave us much time. We must marry on April the 20th. "Yes, make it the 20th, 10 a.m. at the parish church," and he strode away. Catherine kept the appointment, maybe out of curiosity, or perhaps to make him look silly. But there he was, with the ring and the license. Moments later, the kindest and most gentle of men held her firmly by the hand, and Catherine was babbling the responses. Such was the wedding of my maternal grandparents. The rejected suitor took it badly, but he sent them a present. "When you see your deceitful face in this mirror," he wrote, "you will remember the man you have wronged." Catherine laughed at this. With no thought to deceive, she had been overwhelmed by the one man capable of keeping her in order. Truth to tell, life in the village, for one of her lively nature, was deadly dull. Everyone worked for the Great Western Railway, and everyone went to Weston-super-Mare for their 1 week's holiday. All I have of them is two faded little pictures. The lower one was taken in 1869.
What was the village?
And you can see how tiny Catherine
was. What was the name of the village?
It was what is now largely Swindon, but it was, of course, a small part of it at that time. That was the Great Western Works nearby. Alas, Joseph died of fever in the tropics and was buried at sea. Catherine soon followed him, of grief, it was said. They left three small daughters, the eldest being my mother. The scene changes to a village of Chislehurst in Kent. Two gentlemen are called upon the rector. The exiled Napoleon III, whose stately home was opposite the church, had died suddenly, and they were leaving to London to inform the Queen. They asked that bells be tolled in the manner prescribed, this being an event of worldwide significance. Soon after their departure, the bells certainly rang out, but with the most joyful peal in the repertoire. What the sorrowing Empress Eugenie and her retinue could make of this, I cannot imagine. It seems that a young girl who worked in the rector's kitchen was to marry a village lad that morning. Normally, bells were not for the lower strata of society, but the rector had promised and was a man of his word. Somewhat later came the map appeal, but by this time my other grandparents were happily united. My father, their eldest son, was also a seafaring man, yet he joined the infantry in the first month of the 1914 war, and somehow he survived in the frontline trenches at Arras and the Somme. He even captured a German general, relieving him not only of his command, but of his field glasses, which I now possess. If he hadn't got enough to worry about, we boys worried him to bring home souvenirs, as you can imagine. In 1943, the enemy levelled the score when my brother was captured in a one-sided engagement at Spitsbergen in the Arctic. With 14 wounds, he became the only British sailor to have a voyage on the battleship Tirpitz. After the war, he was decorated by King Haakon for shedding his blood in the defence of Norway. He did not explain to the king that he had no such intention. He was, in fact, unarmed and running as fast as he could in the opposite direction to hostilities. Still badly disabled, he hopes to celebrate his 80th birthday this summer. I myself was born in Essex, where I was to live for more than 60 years. Tragedy struck immediately. As I came into the world, so my mother's young and pretty sister died in the next room. My father being away at sea, my mother waited but a few days before she grabbed up the baby and his brother and fled to the family home at Chislehurst. Granny was now widowed. Her tiny house, two up, two down, a box room and a scullery, might seem adequate for one small lady, but the two best rooms were let to a formidable spinster. What a dump, you will say, when you see my slide. And at Christmas, we would be joined by aunts, uncles and cousins. Yet we children thought it a wonderful place. That is what warmth and love can do. In one corner stood a very old clock, said always to come to the eldest son. It was inscribed Nicholas Fry of Godstone, for which no one had an explanation. Many years later, 1958, I noted there was no mention of our family earlier than the 1840s in the church registers. Who were they? Where did they come from, if not from here? Were they worth the bother of research, ordinary folk like us? Then I remembered my great uncle Charles, an exceptional man by any standards. He was the village carpenter. There can be no more honourable profession than that. He was a notable singer and musician, and once a famous artist sketched his noble features as a model for St Matthew in a cathedral window. Amongst his papers, long after his death, I found a letter dated 1880. Here he is. From the town clerk of Reigate. He claimed a family connection and identified us with Surrey at least back to the reign of Charles II. Were we not, he asked, descended from Ephraim Dabner, who somehow disappeared in the year 1750? With this letter was a pencilled note in Charles's handwriting. I've got that too. It was a rough family tree and concluded, my father's grandfather, named Ephraim, called a runaway gentleman. Charles may have replied, but there were no more letters. Jealous of his good name in the village, he kept his secret for 78 years. My next steps were obvious. Parish registers, census returns, wills, record offices, and following up any sort of clue. Searches can be tedious and disappointing, but success is immensely exhilarating. Our family appears to be of Huguenot origin, possibly arriving in this country after the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve. They were, or subsequently became, millers and millwrights, and at some time owned or occupied several Surrey water mills, Shear, Shalford, Chilworth, Abinger, Dorking and Hawley. Closely they followed the Evelyn family, and often were their tenants. One of the first Evelyn powder mills was at Godstone, which seems to solve the mystery of my grandmother's ancient timepiece. There was much intermarrying amongst the milling families. Whether the attraction was the miller's lovely daughter or a chance to inherit her father's mill is not recorded. A special note tonight is the wedding of Thomas Stadner and Rebecca Twist, the daughter of an Albury miller, in 1692. There are several Twist graves in Albury churchyard, including Rebecca's grandparents. These are births and deaths recorded in the old Albury registers from 1665 to 1768, about 100 years. So there are quite a number of them, really. In 1705, they moved to Hawley Mill, which they purchased 5 years later, together with the mill house, orchards, outbuildings and 4 acres for £250. There they lived into old age. Family connections continued there until quite recently, and I was even able to meet the son of the Reigate town clerk, who wrote to great uncle Charles in 1880. The course of the River Mole has now been diverted. I was just in time to see it, as it had been for many centuries. The eldest son, also Thomas, 1693-1771, remained in this area, and he too rests in Albury churchyard. He owned several properties and an interest in at least 4 mills. His parents' former home in Upper Street Shear, he let to his Albury relatives at a peppercorn rent. Earlier, in 1698, the Twists owned 2 acres next to Bullings Peace at Green Hill in the West Field, wherever that may be. Perhaps someone here can help. That somewhere in the middle of that square, and the other owners are, I've noted, John Astreet, John Baker, William Otway, and Bullings Peace. Perhaps you might like to give them thought to that. With his brother John of Shalford, who died in middle age, he owned a barge or barges on the River Wey. An industrial dispute of 1758, when the river bargemen asked an extra 6 pence for making the fortnight's journey to London and back, was settled when Thomas agreed to lend them a boat, provided they put things back as they found them. I have a copy of a Guildford document with Thomas and 5 other local gentlemen walking the bounds of St. Martha's Parish in 1746. This gives details of trees and hedges, and some lanes and paths bear the same names today. I have yet to discover where Thomas actually lived. Here they recorded their findings on their walk around St. Martha's Parish. Thomas Stadner there, the other gentlemen are John Penfold, Richard Boxall, William Stuppold, George Barnes and John Street. I suppose they came along this road here. I mentioned Postford House, that's along there. That's right. But the original document is in Guildford Uniment Room. Thomas left no children, but I gather he was a satisfactory uncle. His will to his nephew, often concludes with the words, "I likewise forgive him the £100 he now owes me." He frames the third son. He inherited 2 mills at Abinger, but was not, I fear, entirely dedicated to his work. He was the sporting type, more interested in his fine team of horses. I suddenly tumbled how he came to sell up and run away when I found his bill of sale dated 1750. Yes, I've got that well. Beautifully written, I imagine, by the legal profession, but he sacks the various items and the money he got for them. It was obviously he had to sell quickly and get out. He signed it twice there because he got the money in 2 instalments. That was the year, 1750, of the dramatic prize fight of Jack Broughton versus Jack Slack. Broughton, the reigning champion, was regarded as a certainty and was backed for huge sums. An unlucky punch caught him between the eyes and temporarily blinded him. He could not come up to scratch as the rules demanded. The Duke of Cumberland alone lost £10,000. I have some evidence that Ephraim's wife, Jane, was Jack Broughton's sister, so that family honour was at stake. Jack would therefore be my great-uncle many generations back. Later he became the yeoman of the King's bodyguard and is buried in the West Cloister of Westminster Abbey. It is interesting to note that he was once a barge man and holder of the coveted Doggett's coat and badge. Ephraim took refuge at Hawley Mill, where he died 3 years later, as did his eldest son. It was another son, also Ephraim, who ran away, like his father, but for different reasons. His mother, Jane, died only a month after making a most unsatisfactory second marriage to a youth little older than her own son. It would appear that Ephraim became a farm labourer, at first sharing a kind of communal existence. Later, with a wife and family, he moved to a cottage at Chelsfield in Kent, about 5 miles from Chislehurst. Of these 18th century ancestors, I know only one by sight, Mary, a sister of the younger Thomas, who married James Constable at St Mary's Guildford in 1737. A bust carved by a contemporary was once exhibited at the Royal Academy. Not long ago, a retired lawyer in New York wrote to claim her as an ancestor and me as a cousin. This was true enough. He had, moreover, in support of his claim, a splendid painting of Hawley Mill as it was when Mary and her husband became its owners. I straightway sought my newfound cousin's advice. Whilst watching a television programme concerning the famous Lady Astor, I noted that her father's middle name was Dabney, far more likely French than American. Back came his reply, "Yes, many of that name claim descent from Dobbin, the historian, friend and confidant to Henry of Navarre. In Virginia," he added, "was the ancient Dabney's Mill, and a certain familiar landmark is still known as Ephraim's Rock." The fact that some Huguenots emigrated first to England and then to America is certainly confirmed in my own research. America claims one of 2 brothers, Christian name John, and there is evidence that these were my Reigate ancestors. I have come a long way from my granny's humble dwelling. Time does not permit me to offer much advice this evening to those with similar aspirations. Computerised records are now widespread. This source of information is inexpensive and often free of charge. I myself have learned very little by this method, but a member of our Surrey Society, upon dialing for a remote Devonshire village, got 7 foolscap sheets of ancestors. Don't be too fussy about the spelling. This will vary greatly. Don't pay for copies of certificates at St Catherine's House unless you are fabulously rich and must have them. Instead, consult the indexes, which are free, and then check up in the relevant parish registers. Wills can be most exciting and revealing of all documents, but they are not easy to trace. I believe a national index is in course of preparation, but at a slow pace, having just reached letter C. This did enable me to read Jack Broughton's will. Here at last, we see our ancestors, not just as names and dates, but as real men and women. For similar reasons, I have tried lately to create some sort of pictorial record of where they lived and worked, and churches at which they joined in worship. All but a few of the slides have some family connection, and I make no claim to be an expert. Many scenes are close at hand and very familiar. I do not seek to excuse them on these grounds. When a man is tired of London, said Dr. Johnson, he is tired of life. There can be few amongst us that cannot say the same about Surrey and about Albury.